Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today, the able analysis of Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Wayne Moyer with us as well, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Well, lots to pick over. We want to eventually, later on in the program, get to your thoughts on the G7 summit blow-up on the weekend and trade implications here for the Midwest. Also, some action there on immigration in the House we haven't been looking at in recent weeks. I'd like to have you share your thoughts on the showdown over DACA, I guess you could say. We heard at the top of the hour news about Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, evidently parting ways with his legal team. We'll follow that during the hour and talk about it, what it may mean a little bit later. But of course, first of all, we want to talk about the North Korean summit, rather the summit that was just held in Singapore not too long ago. Gentlemen, you were on this show. We were talking about the flurry of North Korean nuclear and missile tests, also the angry exchanges between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un that were fueling fears of war only a few months ago. Yesterday, the first summit between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. Let's hear a little bit of the president's evaluation of it. In a news conference after the summit, President Trump said the agreement will end the conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
We're prepared to start a new history, and we're ready to write a new chapter between our nations. Nearly 70 years ago, think of that, 70 years ago, an extremely bloody conflict ravaged the Korean Peninsula. Countless people died in the conflict, including tens of thousands of brave Americans. Yet while the armistice was agreed to, the war never ended, to this day, never ended. But now we can all have hope that it will soon end, and it will. It will soon end. The past does not have to define the future. Yesterday's conflict does not have to be tomorrow's war. And as history has proven over and over again, adversaries can indeed become friends. We can honor the sacrifice of our forefathers by replacing the horrors of battle with the blessings of peace. And that's what we're doing, and that's what we have done.
President Trump in a news conference following the summit with the North Korean leader. We want to reach out to our listeners this hour as well. In this first part, ask you, what do you make of the deal with North Korea? 1-866-780-9100 or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Over the past 24 hours, Wayne and Jim, politicians, commentators, arms experts have been weighing in on the deal reached. Let me start with you, Wayne. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's a positive aspect that the two leaders met each other and there's reduction in tensions. But there are no teeth to this agreement. There's no verification. There's no assurance that North Korea will actually reduce its nuclear armaments. I think North Korea got more out of this than the United States did. The U.S. has said that it will stop its military exercises with South Korea. And also, Kim Jong-un got the benefit of legitimacy of having this meeting to sort of strengthen his international position. I think Trump got very little in return.
Jim, compared to where we were a few months ago, as I referenced, we're in a better position, right?
Well, sure. We're at least not saber rattling as we were just, last summer or so, or last July and August. But I would very much agree with what Wayne said. I mean, the if you look at the substance of the agreement or the statement, this one-page statement or text that was issued, there's really not too much substantive there. I mean, there are some statement about better relations and creating a stable and lasting peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. There's a commitment to work towards denuclearization. And the only really tangible outcome was apparently the agreement on the return of POWs and MIAs and their remains. The rest of it is, you know, I don't want to minimize it entirely, but it's a lot of boilerplate stuff in terms of international diplomacy. It really is just very much the beginning of a process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the president's statement that this is going to end, maybe it will create a treaty for the end of the Korean War, but I think there's quite a few hurdles to overcome here. And certainly there's nothing, as Wayne said, about, you know, the sort of, you know, the administration has been talking about the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. The only passage in the text is a complete denuclearization, a commitment to work towards a complete denuclearization. So there's a long, long road ahead, and, you know, yes, we can be optimistic that we're not in the same place that we were, you know, maybe 12 months ago or so, but we're not there yet.
It was interesting also, too, you mentioned the return of the repatriating the remains of Americans killed in action during the Korean War, a significant number of them. There are 35,000 Americans died on the Korean Peninsula between 1950 and 1953. Now, 7,700 still listed as unaccounted for. The VFW estimating over 5,000 sets of remains in North Korea. So a big thing, especially much appreciated by the families of those service men and women who died there. But also, as I understand it, Wayne, this was added, and I think the president made this point of saying this, added just as an extra thought right at the end and granted.
Yeah, but I should also note that this was in the previous agreements that we had with North Korea as well in 1994 and 2005. So this is not something that's brand new. I think it's a good thing, but this is just a repeat of what's been offered before in previous agreements.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little.
Previous agreements, if I just would weigh in, were much more specific than this. Mm. You know, so maybe we're, you know, sure, there's a process involved here, but so let's keep in mind both in 1994 and in 2005 into 2007 under the six-party talks, the agreements were much more specific, and maybe we'll get to that juncture, but we're clearly not there yet.
Here's some reaction from the former National Security Advisor and UN Ambassador under President Obama, Susan Rice. She says, in spite of the agreement, North Korea's nuclear threat is real, present, and unabated. Here she is speaking on Morning Edition this morning.
It's a rather preposterous claim for the president to tweet that there's no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Worse still, I think it's quite concerning because it suggests one of two things. Either that he views this summit as all show and for political purposes rather than to address the substantive problem of North Korea's nuclear capacity and missile capacity, or that he really doesn't understand at all how grave and how pernicious the North Korean nuclear threat really is, and therefore is not in a position to lead and guide a very serious long-term negotiation to eradicate it.
To elaborate on the tweet that the Susan Rice referenced there, this is a tweet from the president. Everybody can now feel much safer than the day I took office. There is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Meeting with Kim Jong-un was an interesting and very positive experience. North Korea has great potential for the future. Wayne, we have a lessening of tensions because we're talking, right? But that nuclear threat, as present as ever, and it's not going away tomorrow?
No, and I think we have lost some of the leverage that we had in terms of international sanctions against North Korea, which will make it harder, I think, to actually reduce North Korea's nuclear arsenal. I think after this meeting, it's going to be very hard to get both Russia and China to continue sanctions against North Korea, even if the U.S. keeps its sanctions in place. And by Building up Kim Jong-un, I think the president is going to make it harder to maintain international support for sanctions, and our fight with the Europeans isn't helping in that regard either.
Mm-hmm. Jim, comment on that. The other big players here, China and Russia, mentioned by Wayne just now. How does this look from their perspective?
Well, China comes out, I think, very satisfied with the outcome of this particular meeting, particularly as Wayne mentioned that the president announced that they're not going to have these military exercises, these major military exercises. I don't know if that was actually something that the two leaders talked about or if it was just thrown in by the president as an afterthought. Certainly, he did not consult with his allies, and I think that's probably not a very good thing. So China has always been concerned, as has been North Korea, about these exercises, and have labeled them provocative. And I noted that the president, in his statement, called those exercises provocative. I think it's a really a mistake, unless that was a negotiated point, because the United States didn't get very much. And didn't get anything, as near as I can tell. And if it was just thrown in as an afterthought, I think that's probably a mistake on the part of the administration.
When we talk about this phrase, complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, no timeline, no details, but from the North Korean perspective, couldn't we interpret that, Wayne, as also applying to U.S. forces? Now, as far as we know, no land-based nuclear weapons from the U.S. on the South Korean soil, but we do have ships capable of that at South Korean ports. I don't think we say whether they have on them, and certainly bombers with nuclear capability. Now, do they have flyover rights? Is that a question you're thinking about too, Wayne?
It's a huge question, and the North Koreans have, or the agreement does not define what denuclearization actually means. And that's very critical, because in the past, denuclearization for North Korea has meant, as I think you were implying, Ben, keeping American military forces, which have nuclear capabilities, away from Korea. That's a very different question than North Korea reducing its own nuclear capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another point that I think the Chinese would be very happy about. You were asking, Ben, about what the Chinese reaction was, and if that's the sort of the outcome, that's clearly something that the Chinese would favor. One other point about getting rid of these exercises, with the other kind of activities in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, this is also lowering the American presence in the region, and I think that again, is not at this particular juncture a very wise course.
Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College on our Politics Wednesday edition. Starting off with North Korea later in the hour, we'll talk about what seems hard to believe, but it seems like the G7 summit that blew up on the weekend is a long time ago, just a few days ago, folks. We'll talk about that in a minute. But as our news cascades in on us, continues to in the last month or years, actually, in this presidency, actually, more precisely, we get an accelerated sense of news, one overshadowing the one previous to it. Let's talk a little bit about the optics of this summit here and how our president has really done a 180-degree turn on how he feels about the North Korean leader. We can remember Little Rocket Man and all the other things that were said just a few months ago. Here is the president in an interview yesterday with Greta Van Susteren on Voice of America, President Trump describing the North Korean leader.
Really, he's got a great personality. He's a, funny guy. He's a very smart guy. He's a great negotiator. He loves his people. Not that I'm surprised by that, but he loves his people. And I think that we have the start of an amazing deal. We're going to denuke North Korea.
Okay, Wayne, so on a personal level, all of a sudden, we have a great chemistry between these two, or?
Well, personal. personal relationships are important, but one should never forget what North Korea's interests are and how the leader is interpreting North Korea's interests. And my own sense is that Kim Jong-un thinks his nuclear capacity is his means of survival. And will he see his interests in any way that's being gained or improved by doing away with nuclear weapons? And I'm having some trouble understanding how he might feel that way.
So a key here is assuring North Korea that they are secure, that the U.S. is not going to, well, have a Libya scenario play out in North Korea, as John Bolton, I guess, mistakenly brought in to the conversation a few weeks ago. Jim, is there any way the U.S. and its allies can assure the North of the security that it desires in order to give up these nukes?
Well, I suppose they could, you know, sign a non-aggression pact of some sort with the North Koreans, and I suppose they could, you know, maybe lower the American presence in South Korea to give, you know, some confidence. But, you know, I guess I'm of the view too that I really find it really rather remarkable that Kim Jong-un would actually totally give up his nuclear capacity. And plus, and we haven't even talked about it, the whole idea of trying to verify this. I mean, we know that, you know, with other agreements, the difficulties of verification, and it's even more, you know, given that North Korea has, you know, prided itself on sort of being the hermit kingdom and so on. And what I've been able to discern is that the intelligence community really finds it hard to sort of track what is going on within North Korea, given the kind of closed society that it really is. And that's why I guess I sort of take a deep breath, and when the president makes his statement about Kim Jong-un, I think there's more sort of political hyperbole here in terms of negotiating status. Because if you recall, and we haven't even talked about it, I mean, the human rights conditions in North Korea are pretty disastrous.
So give us some specifics on that, Jim, because that's a very important point we do want to get to. I mean, all smiles at this summit, but this leader has a notorious past.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I suppose most notorious is, you know, he's been suspected of killing his half-brother in Malaysia because of the concern about the inherited leadership role within North Korea, and apparently this half-brother must have been cut out of it. And then, of course, shortly after he assumed office, he accused his uncle of being too close to the Chinese and trying to overthrow his regime, and of course he had him killed as well, or executed as well as some military officials. Beyond that, of course, has been the kind of disastrous experience of the North Koreans in terms of the number of people that have starved and so on. I haven't looked this past year, but a couple of years ago I looked at the human rights report that the U.S. State Department puts out in every country around the world. And of course, the North Korean cataloging of the kind of inhumanity there is really quite stark. And this is a country that, again, that I understand that states have to deal with how they're conducting international relations with one another. But this is a regime that is very, very sordid and obviously does not respect human dignity very much.
One other facet before we go to break I wanted to have the two of you reflect on was the video, the movie trailer that was a part of the news conference given by the president and the North Korean leader. I'm reading a Washington Post article off the screen with the headline, "Reporters thought this video was North Korea propaganda. It came from the White House." So this was a view in 4 minutes of what would await North Korea should it buy into this proposal by the Trump administration. Let's listen to an excerpt from the video produced by the White House.
A new world can begin today. One of friendship, respect, and goodwill. Be part of that world where the doors of opportunity are ready to be opened. Investment from around the world, where you can have medical breakthroughs, an abundance of resources, innovative technology, and new discoveries. What if? Can history be changed? Will the world embrace this change? And when could this moment in history begin? It comes down to a choice. On this day, in this time, at this moment, the world will be watching, listening, anticipating, hoping. Will this leader choose to advance his country and be part of a new world? Be the hero of his people? Will he shake the hand of peace?
A video produced by the White House, just about a minute of that, 4-minute video. Wayne Moyer, have we seen anything like this in international diplomacy?
So far as I know, this is the first time of anything like this. I worry a bit that this video could be taken as North Korean propaganda later, and that Kim could say effectively, well, we've made great progress at our meeting, and as a result of my agreement with President Trump, we will make North Korea this way. But what changes will he actually make? How much liberalization can he actually tolerate and stay in power? I don't think we get anywhere with this.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute before we go to break. Jim, your thoughts on this curious video?
Well, I very much agree with Wayne. I mean, the idea that this might be utilized by the North Koreans in terms of advancing their own interests is really very troubling here. I'm not sure what this, except to create this kind of atmosphere that to sort of continue the negotiations on the part of the administration. But it really is a first, as your question posed there, in international diplomacy to use this kind of high-tech video display to further negotiations.
Yeah, stock footage of horses running through on a beach or through water, a lot of interesting thing, condos along a seaside resort. Interesting. Well, we can all hope that the nuclear tensions between the U.S. and North Korea have abated, and it will be promising for the future. We'll see what is built on this summit from yesterday. Jim McCormick and Wayne Moyer, we're going to move on when we come back for more of our Politics Wednesday. We're going to talk about the G7 summit on the weekend and that string of angry tweets by the president criticizing our closest allies right after that G7 summit. When we come back, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mason City TV news anchor Jody Huizentrout disappeared 23 years ago this month. Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear from a group that's dedicated to solving that decades-old mystery. Recently, the group posted some billboards around the Mason City area asking for leads to coincide with what would have been Huizentrout's 50th birthday. Also tomorrow, for you political junkies, a live conversation with Congressman Dave Loebsack. So you can send questions beforehand or dial in during the show. If you'd like to email us with your question for Congressman Dave Loebsack, we'll put as many listener questions to him as time permits, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. It's Politics Wednesday edition with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. And before we go on to look back toward the G7 summit of the weekend and the repercussions of that, let's look forward to some breaking news within the last hour. Multiple news sources saying that the ex- lawyer for Donald Trump, personal lawyer Michael Cohen, likely to cooperate as his attorneys leave the case. That's the interpretation here of the representation of Michael Cohen going away. Thoughts on that, should that prove true. Jim McCormick, let me go to you. What do you think about this development? Because there's been, of course, Michael Cohen at the center of this investigation, right?
Absolutely. I wonder if he actually will cooperate, say, with the Mueller investigation here as a result of this. I tend to doubt it, given his long history with Trump. But it is a kind of a curious development here, sort of on the spot.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add there, Wayne?
Well, we know that Michael Cohen is very, very close to Trump. And certainly heavily involved in Trump's relationship with Stormy Daniels, et cetera. So if anybody has dirt on the president, he's probably the one.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the G summit. What happened on the weekend? Donald Trump firing off a string of angry tweets criticizing America's closest allies. This is hours after leaving that divisive G7 summit in Canada on the weekend. He rejected the G7 joint communique in the air via tweet. He attacked the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, personally, suggesting the Canadian Prime Minister was, in his words, very dishonest and weak, and acts hurt when called out, according to the president. Now, as far as we can tell, these are the comments that got the president so angry with the Canadian Prime Minister. Let's listen to Justin Trudeau outlining his conversation at the G7 with President Trump.
I highlighted directly to the president that Canadians did not take it lightly, that the United States has moved forward with significant tariffs on our steel and aluminum industry, particularly did not take lightly the fact that it's based on a national security reason, that for Canadians who either themselves or whose parents or community members have stood shoulder to shoulder with American soldiers in far-off lands and conflicts from the First World War onwards, that it's kind of insulting. And I highlighted that it was not helping in our renegotiation of NAFTA, and that it would be with regret, but it would be with absolute certainty and firmness that we move forward with retaliatory measures on July 1st, applying equivalent tariffs to the ones that the Americans have unjustly applied to us.
Okay. Also, I think in the news reports, Justin Trudeau saying Canada would not be pushed around. So that is the extent of the Canadian Prime Minister's aggressiveness, Wayne Moyer. This evidently set off the president, or do you understand otherwise?
What I think is that Trump's response had less to do with what the Canadian Prime Minister said than more his appeal to his political base. He's been trying to make the case that the rest of the world is taking advantage of the United States in terms of trade relationships, et cetera, and that the Canadian Prime Minister was objecting to this is a way of making a play to your domestic constituency that the rest of the world is taking advantage of the United States and
mm-hmm.
trade.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, before you weigh in on this, I had Senator Charles Grassley on this program Monday of this week, 2 days ago, and I asked him about retaliation by Canada, how that would impact Iowa. Senator Grassley explained it this way.
It would be catastrophic. From this standpoint, that Iowa produces about a third more than we consume domestically in the United States, I should say Iowa and agriculture generally. So if you can't export it, it means prices are going to fall. And we know from history, that'd be Carter, Reagan, and George W. Bush, when they do put tariffs on, it tends to be first retaliated against agriculture. Now, you might say, well, that's only 5 or 7% of the people in Iowa that are actually farmers. But don't forget, agriculture has a ripple effect through Iowa's entire economy, and it would affect a lot of Iowans. But it'd also be true of agriculture almost anywhere in the United States. And this is why I would not condemn the president from this standpoint, that if a president, any president, could get a better deal for America generally than what previous agreements have, nobody's going to find fault with it. But it's kind of a brinksmanship. And I think the president being a business person, as opposed, for the first time in the history of our country, as opposed to being a politician, he practices what he did in the private sector. If he doesn't go over the brink, then I think it's going to be good news for the United States. If he goes over the brink, it's going to be hurt agriculture very badly.
Senator Charles Grassley from this program on Monday of this week. Jim McCormick, analysis from our senior senator. What do you think of that?
Well, I think he's right, very much on the mark here. Iowa's leading export market is Canada. It's one of the 35 states that has Canada as its leading export and trade partner here. And I think the latest numbers show that there are about $4 billion worth of trade between Canada and the United States. So if there were retaliation, and already the Canadians have talked about if they're going to retaliate, they would retaliate to the farm sector, the agricultural sector, that would actually hurt some of the supporters of Trump within the United States. So Iowa would be a target. So I think it's in some ways it's a very dangerous kind of strategy. And of course, Canada is both in steel and aluminum, the two areas that are going to slap on these tariffs. They are the leading exporters to the United States in both of those commodities there. And so they would actually be very much hurt by it as well. But in some ways, it actually has helped Trudeau because, you know, Trudeau's popularity within Canada has declined recently in this kind of strong statement that he made, you know, that he was insulted and there would be retaliation, has resulted just in the past few days of the Canadian Parliament across party lines passing a resolution supporting the president to stand up against the Americans here. So in some ways, it might be a godsend to Trudeau in terms of his political standing.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just add one very quick thing,
sure, Wayne,
to this? In some ways, by antagonizing Trudeau, Trump is making it harder for a new NAFTA agreement. It's going to be very hard now for Canada to make any more concessions to the United States. So this may delay the completion of a new NAFTA agreement.
Yeah, there's really been on the whole issue that was raised by Trump was, of course, was dairy, that there's a 270% tariff on dairy. And, of course, Canada has this supply management system, which is really quite protectionist in a different way than the United States, which subsidizes agriculture. Canada just uses a different kind of design in terms of supply management, but it effectively keeps, in this case, American dairy outside. So that's one of the areas in NAFTA that, you know, remains a contentious point, as Wayne pointed out. So getting a NAFTA agreement will be problematic.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, as we finish the final 10 minutes or so of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. One of the surprises from the, well, there were several, but one of the big surprises from the president in this G7 summit was his suggestion, more than a suggestion, and wondering why Russia was no longer part of the G7. It used to be the G8, and then we had the annexation of Ukraine. In the meantime, we've had other misbehaviors by Russia, the meddling in our own elections, the poisoning of an ex-spy in the United Kingdom, the killing of journalists, and so forth. So with this backdrop, Wayne, the reports I'm seeing
the Europeans were caught completely off guard, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And of course, the Europeans feel very strongly after the takeover of the Crimea and other Russian behavior in Ukraine. Let me back up a little bit from this. I'm becoming convinced that Trump really doesn't like negotiating with the European Union per se. And he would rather negotiate with the individual countries. He's a bilateralist, not a multilateralist. And I'm wondering, at least part of what he may be doing is to create disunity among the Europeans and sort of work to break up the European Union, which then plays into his sort of bilateral negotiating strategy.
Do you see any signs that he's, I mean, this G7 seemed to unify the Europeans against Trump? We saw that iconic picture. I don't know if iconic is the right word, but the Angela Merkel picture with her hands down on the desk facing Trump with his hands, arms crossed in defiance.
No, I agree with you. I think it is totally counterproductive, but I think that he is trying to create disunity, but I think he's getting the opposite effect.
Mm-hmm. Jim, in your many decades of watching U.S. politics, I just wanted to put your credibility up there on a pedestal there, Jim. Do you recall any time in your decades studying U.S. politics when our relationship with our closest allies has been in worse shape?
I mean, the only thing that I can think of is, you know, at the time of de Gaulle, when he you know, threatened to pull out of NATO, or at least the organizational structure of NATO, the military structure of NATO, not the organization itself, back in the 1960s. I mean, that was a source of tension rather continuously with de Gaulle. But even then, de Gaulle was still reliant. I mean, his famous statement during the missile crisis that if Kennedy said there was missiles in Cuba, he would certainly believe him. So I don't think that I can recall any time when there's been this kind of potential disunity here. And it's hard for me to imagine what the long game is here. I mean, you know, yes, you can have some bilateral agreements maybe to get a little better trade with Germany or with the British or what have you, or even with the French. But it seems that it's totally dysfunctional in terms of trying to deal with a kind of a stable international order.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, comment on that. You've got decades of experience as well as a diplomacy watcher, U.S. politics.
I very much agree with Jim in terms of the importance of a multilateral global order, and I think Trump is very much opposed to that, and is much more comfortable dealing with individual countries. And I think the value of the international order is for him is not very high.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps a quick comment on some other politics in the news. Late yesterday, evidently, moderate and conservative Republicans in the House reaching a deal to vote on two immigration measures this week. Delays for now this discharge petition we've been hearing about, the effort by moderates to force some kind of immigration floor votes on proposals. Jim, quickly, we don't have much time. Enlighten us a little bit on what's going on with immigration in our Congress.
Well, you know, there is sort of the Freedom Caucus that wants, and a bill that's supported by Trump and also came out of Goodlatch's committee here, and it's a very hard-line bill that basically would not, provide the kind of citizenship path for the DACA people, and versus this other more moderate bill that will engender some Democratic support and also some moderate Republican support. So I think where they're at now is what I understand is they're going to basically have two votes. So it'll be interesting to see on the floor how some of those Republicans that are in districts with, say, Hispanic, with a large Hispanic population, how they vote, because that could obviously be consequential in terms of the 2018 congressional election. So, mm-hmm. I think the key thing to watch is which of these bills actually succeed, and then the composition of the support that they engender.
Mm-hmm. We had primaries yesterday. Last week, of course, on Tuesday, was Iowa's included in a group of eight states with their primaries. Yesterday, voters in Virginia, Maine, Nevada, North Dakota going to the polls. Seeing the takeaway here, Wayne, Republican Representative Mark Sanford, former governor there, I guess you don't cross Trump. He was evidently downed, according to analysis, by a Trump tweet.
Yeah, I think that's true. And also, in Virginia, the Republican senatorial nominee turned out to be a very strong Trump supporter. And it seems to me what all this indicates is if you're a Republican now, there are real advantages to supporting Trump and real disadvantages to indicating any kind of difference between your position and Trump's position.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have the ongoing Russia investigations unfolding, and we have our midterm elections coming up. Reports here from Politico on the Russia investigations that a growing number of Republican leaders are sort of saying wrap it up on the Russia investigations. Give us a sense, Jim, perhaps, of where we are. Are we to expect something from Mueller before the election? How close can we, could such an investigation announcement report be delivered so as not to sort of influence, and I think that's the goal here, not to influence the elections.
Well, you know, Rudy Giuliani has talked about trying to wrap this up by September the 1st. So I'm wondering if there is some understanding with Mueller that there would be at least some report out. Sort of, you know, if you think of Labor Day as a kind of a kickoff before the of any election cycle here, maybe that's the kind of target date. I don't know, you know, how things have been going and kind of it's been given the investigation has been spreading out. You know, whether that September 1 date will be met. I think the thing to look, I think tomorrow we're supposed to get, or maybe by Friday, this Inspector General report in terms of the 2016 election, and I think that's probably going to engender lots of coverage and controversy as well.
Do we know what we are to expect there in any way?
Well, you know, they're talking about, you know, what the role of the FBI was and Comey and some of his assistants in terms of the sort of the Clinton investigation in terms of the Clinton activities during the 2016 election. So I think that obviously it's separate from the sort of Russian investigation of Trump, but there's obviously some overlap because of the dossier and all of that sort of thing. So it'll be interesting to see how those things sort of commingle.
Mm-hmm. Well, one quick thing here is that the Mueller report is not instantly public. It goes to the Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, and whether he releases it or not is less, and how fast he releases it is an open question.
Mm-hmm. And also other news with the Deputy Attorney Rosenstein, he's the number two leader of the Justice Department. We just heard news this week he plans to call on the House, the U.S. House, to investigate its own committee staff. Evidently, there was a meeting there in which he sort of butted heads with the House Intelligence Chairman, Devin Nunes. Lots to unpack there. Let me leave you with this. Buried under all the other political news jumped out at me. A radical plan to split California into three states has earned a spot on the November ballot. This is from the LA Times. California's 186-year run as a single entity could come to an end next year as a controversial plan to split the Golden State into three new jurisdictions qualified yesterday for the November 6th ballot. What do you think of that, Jim?
Well, this is a surprise to me, but, you know, California always leads the way, doesn't it? So this will,
okay.
this is yet another instance of that.
Okay, Wayne.
I can't see it happening because I can't see the members of Congress giving California four extra new senators.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your time and your insights. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne and Jim, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Jim.
Once again, a reminder, tomorrow on the program, we are scheduled to have a live conversation with Congressman Dave Loebsack. If you'd like to put a question to the senator, we'll put on air, of course, not all of them, but as many as we have time for, some selected questions. Please email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Your question for Congressman Dave Loebsack tomorrow over the noon hour on our program. Also tomorrow, a group that's dedicating to solving the mystery, decades-old mystery of a disappearance of an Iowa news anchor, Jody Huizentrout, disappeared 23 years ago this month. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. And Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.